Welcome to Radio Who, What, Why. I'm Jeff Scheckman. Even in our siloed, hyperpolarized time, there are issues that are subject to and deserve honest debate. The direction of foreign policy and America's place in the world. Even healthcare is a legitimate subject with many points of view about how best to deliver it to the maximum number of people at the best possible price. People can disagree, as they can about taxes or education policy. But none of that seems to be so with respect to climate change. In an area where the science is clear, it should be a little like math. Generally, there's only one answer as to the fact that it is happening. The consequences of it, however, can still be subject to honest and open debate. So why then does the New York Times think it's okay to have an op-ed columnist who appears in many respects to be a climate change denier, who is focused on the wrong issues about climate change? And why does he flaunt that in his very first column? To try and understand this and put this in context, I'm joined by a man who uniquely understands both journalism and climate science. He's Andrew Revkin. He's a senior reporter for climate for ProPublica. He formerly wrote about these issues for the New York Times and is in fact quoted twice in New York Times op-ed columnist Brett Stevens' first column. It is my pleasure to welcome Andrew Revkin to the program. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm glad to be on. Thanks.
Do you sense that there is something uniquely different in talking about the politics and the issues surrounding climate science and climate change as opposed to some of the other issues we might be talking about and debating about in this day and age?
Well, your intro was really good. The one thing that gets missed in the climate debate is that the facts include a lot of things we don't know. In other words, it's clearly established that greenhouse gases function, that more of them warm the world, and that they're warming the world. There's no other thing that explains warming since 1950, unless you include a dominant role for the buildup of greenhouse gases from people. Those are basic things. The long-lived nature of CO2. You know, you burn a chunk of coal. It's been in the ground for tens of millions of years, and that it's been out of circulation. And you're adding more CO2 to the air. The CO2 lasts centuries, if not longer, in circulation, and that so it builds like unpaid credit card debt. You know, just stopping your spending doesn't even necessarily reduce the amount of the air, just like it doesn't take away your debt if you slow down your rate of spending. So those are all facts. But then here, the hard thing is that I kind of said this a few times in pieces, there's 100% certainty that the most important aspects of the global warming problem are still durably unclear. And those are, how warm is it going to get? And that means from just some given buildup of CO2 and other greenhouse gases, like doubling the amount that was there for a very long time before the Industrial Revolution, doubling the concentration in the atmosphere. There have been, literally, since 1979, there's been more and more and more science and supercomputers and data thrown at this. And, you know, we've had all those decades of accumulated climate patterns to look at. And the range of possibilities is still basically from manageable to catastrophe, you know, from a couple of degrees to 7 or more degrees centigrade. And that's kind of, it's the same. It's been the same. And it's actually, the range widened between the last two reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So when you have, it's almost approaching what I call, you could call a known unknowable. There's no evidence that some magical new study a couple of years from now is going to suddenly say, oh, no, now we know for sure it's going to be, you know, 3 or 4 degrees, a real danger to everything. So that's a problem, because that means when you have that level of uncertainty, then that allows anyone with if you have an agenda, that means you can find your agenda in that uncertainty, whatever it is. And it means that the policy responses are tougher. You know, it's always harder for us to... It's different than if an asteroid was identified that's going to hit the world in 2035. And I've written a lot about that very scenario, where there'll be a day when an astronomer will spot an asteroid, and with precision, you'll say, you know, you can actually calculate because of the mathematics and astronomy are wonderful. You know, okay, it's going to hit the world on August 25th, 2035. And we'd still have some fights about what to do. But that's different than global warming. And that's just one of the durable uncertainties. As I wrote in my piece, I wrote a piece that responded to,
right,
reflected on Brett's piece for ProPublica, and included more granular issues that are also durably uncertain, like, is sub-Saharan Africa going to get wetter or drier? Science doesn't know, and still doesn't know after decades of science. So that means uncertainty, and that's one of the things he was pointing out, the uncertainty. There's tons of it, and it's real. And the science has never hidden that. Or, you know, the debates have hidden that sometimes, but not the science.
The problem is that the uncertainty, the legitimate unknowables, as you say, give issues to both sides. To the deniers, it gives them license, or they think that it gives them license, to make the denial case. And on the other side, when you debate these issues and you talk about these uncertainties and what the consequences might be, it prevents a really full blossoming conversation about that for fear that somebody is making the case that they're being deniers of climate change.
Well, even it's kind of worse than that. I think some of the fear of acknowledging the uncertainty has been a legitimate fear that people fuzz out. You know, the average person. It's not just sort of the statists and activists. It's most of us live fossil fueled lives, and you know, nudging society to get serious about moving in different directions. There's this what's called status quo bias. The social and behavioral scientists have all these very scary bodies of science. The other science that people sometimes deny is that people are really not good at facing certain kinds of uncertain risks. And I think there's been a fear of acknowledging the complexities and uncertainties because then we'll all just fuzz out. And, you know, I think that's a legitimate fear. Although there's all this work that I also had written about for years saying that trying to jog people to worry about something. There was a famous cover story, a Time magazine cover back in 2006. The cover was a polar bear looking at open water from an ice floe, and it said, "Be worried, be very worried." You know, the idea that you can impose urgency on people and make them nudge them out of a comfort zone is not really supported by the science either. So I kind of understand why, and that's why Scott Pruitt in his EPA testimony, in a bunch of statements recently, including on MSNBC, the new EPA administrator, he talks about, we don't know, therefore we need to discuss things more, which completely, and that's part of the argument that Brett had that I found hard to see a basis for, because, you know, when you know something's unknown, but you know that the one side of it is really consequential and can last for centuries of impacts, that's not automatically an argument for stasis, and certainly not an argument for more study, because the science says clearly that more analysis isn't going to narrow that range.
And one of the impacts that it has, as you were alluding to before, is that it overstates, it drives people to overstate the potential calamities on the other side.
Yeah, well, I wrote a piece in 2006. It was the same year. It was Earth Day 2006, a piece called Yelling Fire on a Hot Planet. And it was about all the, the yelling was getting loud back then already. And it really did sort of, that was the biggie. That period is when the intensity really built around this issue. There were other periods earlier, the run-up to the Kyoto Protocol in the 90s. And I've been writing about this since the 80s. So, I see these patterns come and go. But yeah, it's a natural tendency of people to run to the ramparts. And sadly, it's an issue where oversimplification doesn't really hold up. And how that gets us progress in a world where everything is a meme or a hashtag, it's hard to see. I was teaching the last 6 years before I got back into full-time journalism in between the Times and ProPublica, and I was teaching online communication courses and how to separate fact from fancy, and the hard thing about fake news and all that stuff isn't It's really easy to figure out what's fake. It's really hard to be motivated to do that. That's where we're kind of, that's the hard part. How do you build motivation to care about complexity and to say, you know, this is something we have to act on, even though it'll never be clear until it's too late.
You talk about writing about these things since the 80s. How have those unknowables that you were talking about before, how have the unknowables changed in the past 20, 30 years?
Well, the ones that there's been a robust, I think the robustness of certain things being unknowable has built. And then you have this tendency there's a phrase, it's been used in different ways, called negative learning, but it's basically, in science historically, there's been this pattern where something, an initial idea is stark and dramatic and powerful and gets the front page attention, and, you know, and then science digs in more. Science is a process of falsification. It's the whole idea of moving from a hypothesis to an established theory, like, is that you test and test and test and challenge and find ways to negate what you think might be happening. And what's left is reality. And so what happens with, like, hurricanes, in 1988, when I was writing about hurricanes in a global warming situation, Perry Emanuel, who's kind of one of the great scientists in this area, was, you know, it was a simple thing, you know, warmer seas, more powerful hurricanes. They sort of get nourished by warm water. And that can happen, but what's happened since then is much more of a nuanced picture of the environment around a hurricane. Includes things like wind shear. So turns out in a warmer climate, there'll be, in key zones of the world, there'll be more wind shear. Wind shear kind of rips the tops off of warming hurricanes and tends to kill them. El Nino years are bad years for hurricanes in the Atlantic, anyway. And that's a poorly understood dynamic. So the latest, so from 1988 until now, almost 30 years, a warmer world, you know, now they're saying, well, by 2100, it looks like hurricanes will tend to get stronger. There'll be more hurricanes in more powerful categories, but it also looks like there'll be fewer hurricanes overall. And it's all with this very long time scale that there's no way right now to say that. In fact, there was just a study in January, which I included a mention of in my piece on ProPublica.org on the Bret Stephens thing, which said that, you know, now it looks like the conditions that foster the formation of hurricanes also tend to buffer the U.S. East Coast from getting hammered by them. Just this warm water, you can get sort of a buffer zone. And so again, more study doesn't always lead to more clarity. And that's, you know, as a science writer, that it took me some time to learn that even. And the piece that Bret Stephens linked to of mine described my own sort of learning curve as a science journalist and that stuff.
One of the other impacts that it has is it makes it not only hard to write about, but much, much harder to try and craft public policy around.
Yeah. Although there are some really smart people who've been working on this a long time. And last fall, I was invited to come speak at the meeting of the Society for Decision Making Under Deep Uncertainty. It's deepuncertainty.org is their website, and it sounds kind of like out of some movie. Who could these people be? But they're from they're from all over. They're from the World Bank, from the RAND Corporation. That's this entity that grew up after the 40s onward to help the government deal with complex problems, including defense stuff. So they're not, it's not like liberals, you know. It's sort of, they study financial collapse risks and stuff, all these kinds of areas where there's deep uncertainty, but you have to make a decision. And a throw of the dice doesn't do it. There are strategies that actually make sense. And when you know things that you don't know, It sounds very Rumsfeldian, but he was right about some things. But like known unknowns and known unknowables can help you shape how you build policy. And I'll say, you know, some of this is beyond my realm, but there are people that I draw on you know very well, and this has been integrated into the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports, and it's so it's something that's doable, but it's hard. And none of that, you know, how do you get sound bites out of, you know, sort of nuanced conclusions about things? And that's the hard part.
How much of this sense of what we've been talking about, how much do you think that entered into the decision that was made by the New York Times to put Brett Stevens on the op-ed page to begin with?
I haven't talked to James Bennett. You know, when I did Dot Earth, the last 6 years of Dot Earth, my blog at the Times, were written for the opinion desk. My opinion was that reality matters for those who were curious, and that's why I was never very good at like doing a simple opinion column. But the I haven't talked to Bennett about it. I don't know. My guess is that they were focused on that wide range of things. He writes in foreign policy, in which, you know, Brett seems to be comfortable and in a field of fire. my guess is climate wasn't something that was even really on the radar in terms of thinking about his merits or detriments as a columnist at the Times. And I don't know. Because it's not, you know, it's still even... The paper is doing amazing things, hiring a batch of new people and pulling together an effort under Hannah Fairfield, who's now the first time they've had a climate editor, to integrate a lot of reporting and graphics and everything, laying this issue out for on the news side. But it's overall still an issue that's tended to be kind of wonky and not necessarily at the front of the pack.
Do you think that it does a disservice to people trying to understand all these aspects of climate change and really the nuances that we've been talking about when these subjects become such hot-button issues as they did, for example, with respect to the hiring of Brett Stevens and his first column?
Let me come back at you in a different way.
Sure.
One thing I've concluded about the story is that it's not one story. That what we keep bundling is the climate change problem. It's really about two things, for the most case, energy choices and vulnerability to the hazards that the climate system can throw at us, and along with sea level rise, you know, coastal hazards. And there's a ton that can be done to build cogent, simpler stories with a much broader buy-in when you break it down into what do we want our energy future to look like? And how do we want to build societies here and elsewhere, especially in poor places, that are less vulnerable to droughts, floods, wildfires, et cetera? And if, you know, theoretically, the question is, what do we want? You know, what do we want? And I think what we want is a sustainable relationship with the climate system and sustainable energy choices. And this is true across a much wider swath of not just American society, but society more generally. And so then you can start to have richer, more concrete and answerable questions. You look at the wildfire zones in the West and you say, well, what's actually causing the losses here that matter to us? And you realize right away that by far, the dominant factor driving wildfire patterns through much of the West is where we're building and how we're building, and increasingly it's invasive species of grasses that have moved into parts of the West that provides the tinder for these fires. And there was a really important study that showed the connection between that grass and wildfire intensity. It's, zoning. It's harder for a Governor Jerry Brown or someone to say, hey, you know, we're going to keep having these terrible losses in the Monterey area as long as we're building in these woods that are just so not just prone to burn, but because of 100 years of fire suppression are inevitably going to burn. So let's focus on, can we have an agreement on how to do more managed burns of the fires so they're not calamitous? That's something you can do right now, and it doesn't get into this. By the way, one of the other important realities about the climate problem, the climate change problem, that gets, I wouldn't say denied, but it's kind of negated, is that the system has a momentum and inertia. It's in motion. There's nothing that even a perfect policy on mitigating greenhouse gases. That, you know, suppose there was some magical way right now to start reducing them, which won't happen in a world heading toward 9 billion people with a middle class growing really fast. But suppose it's possible, and then that wouldn't actually show up in the climate system. You wouldn't see the response in the system for several decades. There's a YouTube video interview I did with two guys at MIT that lays this out pretty clearly. And so so we're stuck with the vulnerability being the priority anyway, meaning what can we do right now to make people less vulnerable to these hazards? And that's, and you can have libertarians and liberals agree on a lot of things there right away. So that's, to me, that's the opportunity that arises. And that's about, you know, so what is the story? You know, how do you, what is the story? If more people, including journalists, stopped and said, okay, what's the issue here? And you start to break it into pieces, I think it gets to be more addressable and less likely to get into these kind of flame-throwing, caricatured arguments.
Andrew Revkin, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, I appreciate it always. It's a long story. It will continue.
Andrew Revkin, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Take care. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for listening and joining us here on Radio Who, What, Why. I hope you join us next week for another Radio Who, What, Why podcast. I'm Jeff Shekman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes. You can also support this podcast and all the work we do by going to whowhatwhy.org/donate.